You're listening to the podcast version of Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. I'm Shayla Shapiro. Write the Book airs every Monday at 2 on the Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMM-LP, Burlington, Vermont. The show features interviews with authors, poets, illustrators, agents, editors, and other people in the book industry. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear an interview from the archives with Kate Messner, award-winning author of more than a dozen current and forthcoming books for young readers. Kate Messner's first novel, The Brilliant Fall of Gianna Z, won the 2010 E.B. White Read Aloud Medal for Older Readers, while its follow-up, Sugar and Ice, was a Junior Library Guild selection. Kate is also the author of the popular Marty McGuire chapter book series and Silver Jaguar Society mysteries with Scholastic. Her picture books with Chronicle Books include Sea Monster's First Day and Over and Under the Snow, an E.B. White Read Aloud honor book, and New York Times and ALSC notable book. Kate is a former middle school English teacher who also wrote Real Revision: Author's Strategies to Share with Student Writers, a book about the revision process for teachers and writers. Kate lives on Lake Champlain with her family, where she enjoys spending time outside, biking, hiking, swimming in the summer, skiing and skating in the winter. Of course, she also loves curling up with a good book any day of the year. When I spoke with Kate Messner in 2011, we discussed her then new book, Over and Under the Snow. I asked her to talk about her inspiration for the book, which was a field trip with her seventh grade class.
I was teaching seventh graders, and we, for several years, did a snowshoe field trip to the Visitors Interpretive Center at Paul Smith's College in the Adirondacks. And this was one of those trips. We'd been out in the woods snowshoeing. And at one point, we had gotten off the trail and were kind of going through the trees. And our naturalist, who was guiding us, stopped and said, oh, look at that. And there were a tiny set of mouse tracks or something that size, bull or mole maybe, leading into a crack in the snow and just disappearing down that crack. And she said, wow, there's been a visitor from the Subnivian Zone. And I said, can you just talk a little bit more about that? Because I'm a complete word geek, and I loved the word Subnivian. I thought it sounded all, you know, dark and mysterious.
Right.
And so she talked with our kids about the Subnivian Zone, this area between the winter snowpack and the ground, where, you know, all the smallest forest animals stay safe and warm, and they can hide from predators there and find, you know, little bits of moss and leaves left over from the spring and fall. And so I thought it was just a really great story, and it really made me think about what's happening under the snow while we're, you know, snowshoeing or cross-country skiing over the snow. And that's where the story came from. So on the school bus, on the way back, I turned over the attendance paper, and on the back of it wrote the first draft of Over and Under the Snow.
And you'd never heard, or you weren't familiar with the Subnivian Zone before that, as far as that term?
I had heard, I mean, I obviously was aware that things happened under the snow in the winter, and I think everybody has probably seen the, you know, when the snow starts to melt and you see the tunnels underneath that the chipmunks and squirrels and things have created. But I guess I didn't realize quite the extent to which there was a whole world down there, and that's what was really eye-opening for me on this trip.
Right. Now, one of the characters in the book is the father of the narrator. It's a father and daughter, and they're out cross-country skiing. And so he calls it, he refers to it as a secret kingdom under the snow. And so now that you've told that story, I'm curious if the naturalist who was with you did that as well, or if that was something you came up with for the father.
Secret kingdom was, that's my writer's imagination. I think the naturalist was probably more scientific about it than that.
Yeah.
But just describing, you know, all these things happening. And really for me, the magic in this story is these are things we don't even think about. I mean, you know, when you're hiking through the woods or cross-country skiing through the woods, so often you're, you know, for me, I'm out getting exercise and I'm, you know, noticing maybe how beautiful the snow is on the trees or the sunshine, but I'm not necessarily thinking about what's going on under the snow.
Right.
So that to me brought out the line, the secret kingdom.
Yeah, yeah. And on a beautiful winter's day, I think there's a lot of focus upward to the sky and the sun because we kind of crave that in the winter, but looking down at what's happening underneath is really interesting thing to do.
Exactly, and I think if you're that that deer mouse or that vole, it's a pretty safe, comfortable place to be, especially if there are predators over the snow.
Right, right. Now, I'm sure this is a much different version of the book that's now in bookstores than that first draft that you wrote on the back of that attendance sheet, but how much is different, and what do you think is the biggest change from that first day that you thought of this?
Actually, this book in particular, the structure of the book, the idea of over the snow and under the snow, if you've read the book, you know that it goes back and forth between, you know, what the girl is doing over the snow and what's happening under the snow. So that rhythm was really there from the start, that over the snow, this, and under the snow, this. Mm-hmm. And I think the thing that changed the most was I came back and I did some more research about the different animals and really played around with the language. That was something that in this book was really important to me, to make sure every verb, every word was just exactly perfect for the animal and it fits. So that was probably the biggest change, was the individual words and making sure that everything was exactly the right word. I'll agonize over a word for, gosh, hours sometimes in a picture book, because picture books are so short, and really every word does matter.
Yeah, yeah. And it is very informative, but it's also a really nice story about this girl and her father. And so I wondered how you decided to present this from her point of view, and why a father? I mean, I'm just curious, you know, you're a mom, so, you know, maybe it would have been a natural move to go ahead and make it a mother. So I'm curious what your thought process was to bring her out into the woods cross-country skiing with her dad.
I have memory. Well, first of all, we cross-country ski as a family, and I think some of our best experiences as a family happen outside. I mean, whenever I think of our most fun times as a family or most special times, it's always an outside scene that I picture, whether it's winter or summer. And I think that's something that a lot of families have lost kind of in our digital age, mm-hmm. is that time together outside. So that seems to me like a logical way to tell this story, is to bring a family outside to tell it. And, you know, I don't know why it's a dad and not a mom, because I do cross-country ski with my kids, but my husband does too. And when I was a kid, we lived out in the country, and I remember cross-country skiing with my mom and dad. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. Sometimes when I'm writing, it's just one parent's, when I'm writing the original draft of that story, I guess it was just dad's voice that I heard, and maybe that was because the naturalist was a man, and that was the voice that was in my head. I'm not quite sure.
That's interesting.
Could have been either.
Yeah, and her mom does show up in the book, although you kind of have to look for her, but she's there toward the end of their outing, and I loved that by the end it's all of them together out there.
She does. Yeah, she does. She shows up for the fireplace.
Right. I know, I totally wanted to be on that trip with them, because they like roast marshmallows at the end and stuff. So you mentioned a minute ago that you wanted to do really a good amount of research to make this book really accurate and just right. So I'm wondering how you approach research for your books, sort of more generally, not just this one, but you know, your books vary a lot. So do you have a certain resource that you tend to go to first all the time, or?
Inevitably, I start in the library, and not necessarily with the online resources. My first go-to resources are always books, and sometimes even children's books. It's a really great way to get an overview of a topic. And from there, I'll get into a lot more specialized books and, very, very specific books about animal ecology, you know, in the winter, and, you know, what different species are doing in the winter. So definitely the first stop for me, no matter what I'm researching, whether it's animals or tornadoes or whatever, is the library. But from there, I really like to do two things. First of all, I love to talk with people who are experts in a topic and who are passionate about that, mm-hmm. because they always end up knowing something that nobody thought to put in a book, or they've mm-hmm. seen something that nobody thought to put in a book. And so that's a great resource. And if I can, I always like to spend some time in the place that I'm writing about, because no matter what that place is, whether it's, you know, the woods, and I did go back out onto the trails in the Adirondacks many times while I was working on this book and revising this book, and, you know, just spent time in the quiet of the woods listening and really looking carefully and noticing things and smelling things and really, you know, thinking about all the senses that are part of an experience in the woods. And I think being there is probably the best. Once I have the background information from the books and the interviews, being in a place always makes a huge difference in my writing, whether that's, you know, the woods or, you know, I have a mystery called Capture the Flag coming out this May that has to do with the giant flag that inspired the Star Spangled Banner is stolen from the Smithsonian Museum of American History.
Oh, wow.
And I was lucky enough to spend the morning at the museum before it opened, you know, riding the freight elevators and figuring out exactly how this flag could be, you know, hypothetically stolen from the museum. And the curator helped. It was great, great fun. But the details that come out of an experience like that are, you know, they're details that you can't make up. So that's usually the finishing touch for me is spending some time in the place. And I usually get a lot of great details out of that.
Yeah, and I would think that when you ask people to help you, they must sort of get into it too. If they're experts in it, it's kind of fun for them to talk about it. Is that true? I mean, do you find that people are usually pretty generous with their time?
Yeah, people are incredible. I mean, when you think about it, it's the first couple of times as a writer, I had to pick up the phone and call somebody and, you know, you have to explain who you are and that you're writing this book. And there is that worry, you know, what if they think it's silly or what if this? But the reality is most people really love the opportunity to talk about something they're passionate about. Mm-hmm. I mean, you think about it. How often does somebody call you up and say, could you tell me everything you know about your favorite thing to talk about?
Yeah.
I mean, it's just not an opportunity that comes along every day.
Right.
So I will say when I called up the Smithsonian and explained that I was interested in figuring out how to steal a flag, there were some raised eyebrows, I'm sure, until they, you know, checked out my credentials. And they're like, well, yeah, she has this contract with Scholastic to write the book, so it's okay.
Yeah.
But after that, you know, the gentleman, the curator who invited us down, was just unbelievably nice. He said, you know, maybe you want to bring your family, too. I bet your kids would love that. And so we all went. And he literally took us through the exhibit, you know, we rode the freight elevators, checked out the back hallways and the basement, and, you know, literally talked our way through how would we steal this flag? You know, if we were these bad guys in the book, how could they possibly go about it? You know, and that's just, it's a great experience. And talk about fun. I mean, research is play for me.
Yeah, that's really fun. Now, another book that you wrote recently, that I read recently, was Sugar and Ice, which is a young adult novel. And it's got to do with competitive ice skating. And I wondered if you did a lot of research on competitive ice skating or if you know that world already.
I know that world, but not in the sense that the character knows it.
Mm-hmm.
I have a daughter who figure skates, but she is does not skate competitively. She's a, you know, terrifically talented skater, but chooses not to compete, and she likes to teach younger kids. She likes to do our local skating show. She was actually had signed up for a day camp in Lake Placid at the Olympic Center
mm-hmm.
for figure skating. And my big plan was I was going to take her to her camp and go to the coffee shop across the street and work on revising one of my other novels. Well, when I got there, I realized I hadn't read the fine print and that when you signed your kid up for the skating camp, you were also signing yourself up for a figure skating parent education program.
Oh.
And this program was really designed for parents of competitive skaters. So there was information about, you know, coaches and competition and what dress and how to sew on the, excuse me, the brightest sequins and, you know, these $1,000 skate blades and all these things that really weren't part of our world, but were really pretty interesting. And then there was a sports psychologist there who talked a lot about how she works with kids to keep the sport a healthy one. And I thought, gosh, what a fascinating world this would be to set a book in. So I actually started jotting down some notes, and that's the setting for Sugar and Ice. That's where
yeah.
that story comes from.
Yeah. Now, how often does that happen where you're working on one project and you said you had to do revisions on another novel and then this kind of cropped up? So are you often working on two things at once?
Pretty much all the time, two,
yeah.
two or more, because what happens is I might write a draft of a book. You know, a great example is this summer I finished a you know, second or third draft of a book that is coming out in 2013, and I sent it off to my editor. That book will be with her for several months,
mm-hmm.
you know, while she is reading over it and making suggestions to me and, you know, doing her job. And while she's doing that, I'm working on, you know, several new upcoming picture books that I have coming out over the next few years. So there's a lot of back and forth, and really almost always I'm working on a couple things at once. The real issue comes up when you're in the middle of something and on deadline and you have this other idea tugging at you. So usually when that happens, I'll give myself 20 minutes and I'll just do a real quick write and write down everything I can think of in a file and then tuck it away and say, all right, you're next. It's like two projects in line.
That's exciting. That's kind of fun to always have so many ideas. So, Kate, you are a teacher. You teach, is it the seventh grade? Is that what you said?
Yep, I've taught seventh grade English for 15 years.
Okay. Now, I'm wondering when you're writing, I guess any age level, you write for all different age children. So I'm wondering, when you're writing, are you thinking about how teachers might use your books in the classroom, or do you not really think about that audience as you're writing?
When I'm writing a book, I'm really only writing it for kids, and really for myself in a lot of ways, and the kid that I was when I was 10 or 12. It's after I finish a book that I start to think, how might this be useful for teachers in the classroom, and how might librarians share this with book clubs? And so I do think about those things, but really it's after the book is complete and when I'm working on maybe a discussion guide or something like that.
Okay. Now, how have children been reacting to Over and Under the Snow when you've gone to give a reading or discuss it, maybe in schools or libraries? Have you had a lot of reaction yet?
Yeah, it's been great fun. I mean, that's really what I'm in this for, is because I love to read to kids and share stories with kids. And that book in particular has just gotten an amazing response from kids, I think because there's a little bit of a mystery and everybody likes to know a secret. And so the idea of getting a glimpse of that secret world under the snow, that's familiar, because we all like to go out in the snow, familiar and kind of exotic and different all at once is pretty cool. So kids have really enjoyed the book so far, and actually, at the book festival I was at last weekend, it was the top seller of all of my books, and just disappeared by noon. My stack of books was gone.
So that's great.
It's been really great to see.
Yeah. Now, I would think that a book like this, because it's got, as you said, it's got a story, it has a little bit of a mystery, there's a hidden world, but it's also got a lot of science in it. So, or natural, you know, natural world science.
Yeah.
Do the kids have a lot of questions for you? Do they want to know more about the fox? Do they want to know more about the mouse, you know, in particular?
Yeah, actually, with this particular book, I've been doing a lot of Skype visits with classrooms all around the country and the world, actually. And the kids do have fantastic questions after they've read the book. It's really interesting because it ties in with an awful lot of curriculum units about, you know, ecology and wildlife and hibernation and what animals do in different seasons. So it's been great fun to answer all those questions from kids.
Yeah. Now, how has the Skype setup worked for you? Has your publicist set that up for you? Is that how that works? Or
No, that's actually just something that... It's interesting, as somebody who has spent time both teaching and writing, I always hear teachers saying, wow, I wish I could connect my students with more authors. And then I hear writers saying, boy, I wish I knew how to connect with teachers in classrooms. And so as somebody who's had, you know, kind of one foot in each world, it's been interesting for me to say, you know, you guys really ought to get together more often. So I actually just kind of put out the word on my website that I would offer a free 20-minute Skype Q&A session for any class or book club that had read one of my books and wanted to ask questions about it. And that's been, you know, terrifically popular. It's something that a lot of classes have taken advantage of, because traditional author visits, in-person visits, can be really expensive, and not all schools have the funding for that, as amazing as an experience as it can be. So that Skype visit offers an alternative that really any classroom can take advantage of, and it's gone really well. It's been a lot of fun, I think, for me and for the kids.
Yeah, that's great. Well, you mentioned your website, so I just think I'll put it out there that your website is katemessner.com, and it's a wonderful website. We'll talk more about that in a little bit, but since you mentioned it, I thought I should say what that is before I forget.
Thank you.
Sure. So Over and Under the Snow is illustrated by Christopher Silas Neal. I thought he really captured the sense of this quiet and beautiful snowy day just perfectly, you know. And I wondered how you reacted to the illustrations when you first saw them, and also if you had any input as to the style of the work or the artist himself.
Well, a lot of people are surprised to know that when an author writes a picture book, the author does not choose the illustrator.
Right.
That's actually something that happens at the publisher for the most part. And I work with Chronicle Books, with my picture books, and they're actually an amazing, amazing team. Their art director and their whole design team is really just phenomenal. They do beautiful, beautiful books. So I was thrilled to have this book with them. And when they bought this book, they said, we really need just the right illustrator. And they actually sent me several links to illustrator websites and sample illustrations. And they don't have to give me input, but they did.
That's nice.
And so we talked a lot, and we all really felt like Chris Silas Neal's work just struck the perfect tone for this book. It just seemed to strike the perfect mood. And thankfully, he liked the story and was interested in doing it. And I saw some early sketches. It was interesting because this book has a lot of nonfiction in it. In addition to the kind of poetic story of the girl and her dad in the woods, there was a lot here that needed to be accurate to make mm-hmm. this a useful book for the classroom as well. And so I did see some early sketches of this, and there were some, you know, things that I sent notes on along the way. Like, I think in one of the early sketches there were, you know, a whole bunch of frogs hibernating together as if they were having a party in, you know, in one area. And, you know, frogs hibernate alone. So that was, you know, a note that I sent back, and the sketch was revised. So in a book like this, an author actually may have more input than she would in a fiction situation. So I did see sketches early on. And as the work developed, it just became clear every draft that this is just going to be a stunning collection of illustration. I'm just thrilled with the way it turned out.
Now, at the back of the book, you include an author's note or an afterword, but you also include a whole lot of descriptions of individual animals in their natural world in the winter. So I'm wondering if that was part of your original vision for the book, or was this added later?
That was something that my editor asked for. And I thought it made an awful lot of sense.
Yeah.
And it was a great fun for me to write anyway, because I was the kid who was the complete research geek growing up. I would assign myself reports in the summertime and be like, all right, you have 5 pages on gorillas by Friday. so I love, you know, I just love exploring the natural world and learning about it. And so that was a very natural extension for me. And I completely understood how that would make the book, you know, even more useful as a tool for teachers and librarians.
Yeah. Well, now you mentioned when you were a kid, you know, you used to write essays and stuff for yourself. So how did you originally come to writing? Have you been writing stories since you were a kid as well?
Yeah, I really have. I've always loved writing stories ever since I was in you know, first or second grade. And what happened to me is what I think what happens to a lot of kids. I grew up in a really small town, and we didn't have authors who lived there. And, you know, we didn't have author visits, and we didn't have the internet back then, so we didn't have Skype author visits even. And I loved to read, but it never occurred to me to put those two thoughts together, that I could be somebody who wrote, you know, the books that kids read. And so when I, you know, grew up loving to write, I remember my guidance counselor saying, well, you know, journalism would be a good job for you. And so I looked into that, and it sounded like fun. And that was actually what I went to college for.
Okay.
So I did 7 years in television journalism, actually, as a TV news reporter, before I sort of found my way back to teaching. I'd grown up in a family of educators, and really felt like that was something that I wanted to do, too. So I actually went back to school to get my teaching degree, and it was after I'd spent some time teaching and also had kids of my own that I sort of found my way back to storytelling, and that was when I started writing more seriously for publication.
Okay. Now, where did you said you grew up in a small town. Where did you grow up?
I grew up in Medina, New York, which is between Buffalo and Rochester in western New York.
Okay. And then you also mentioned having gotten your journalism degree. Where did you go to school?
I went to Syracuse University, to the Newhouse School of Journalism.
Now, as I mentioned before, you write for children of all ages pretty much. Is that?
I don't really have any books for teenagers, just young teenagers, but I haven't done too much in terms of older young adult stuff.
Okay.
My book coming out in March is called Eye of the Storm, and it's actually a dystopian novel about a future world where tornadoes have gotten much more powerful and widespread than they are now, and that's kind of the oldest thing I've written, and it's for ages 10 to 14.
Do you have a favorite age group that you write for, or are they all sort of fun?
Oh, they're all really fun. I can't really limit myself to one age group. I think somehow, deep down inside, I'm still all of those ages. And so I really love all those levels of stories.
Do you find that your journalism background helps in writing stories for just every age group, or is it more useful in some ways than others?
I think my journalism background, in some way, well, first of all, it made me really good with deadlines,
yeah.
So that's a good thing. But second of all, it makes me really comfortable as a presenter and as a speaker, and that's something that I have ended up doing a lot of in connection with my writing. So, yeah, I think it's come in handy in a lot of ways.
Did you do television news in the Adirondacks, or where was that?
I did. I actually started in Syracuse.
Okay.
I did some producing and just a little bit of reporting. And then I was a TV news reporter at WPTZ in the Burlington-Plattsburgh market for, gosh, a bunch of years, from 91 until 96, I guess.
Okay, let's talk a little more about your website, which, as I said before, is katemessner.com. And in a Q&A on your website, you say, I'd much rather write for kids. I believe the books we read as kids are books that help shape us in a way that adult books can't quite do, no matter how beautifully they're written. So I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit more about this. I loved that sentiment, and I just thought it would be an interesting topic.
Well, when I think back to my life as a kid, the books that I read, I was a huge reader, and the books that I read when I was 9 and 10 and 11 and 12 years old really are important to me and remain important to me.
Mm-hmm.
I think the books that we read as kids are I guess, shape us in a way that books that we read later on really can't do because, you know, we're all grown up then. But to me, a book that you read when you're 10 just is helping you figure out who you are and who you want to be and how you fit into the world. And I think that's just, it's honestly, it's a huge responsibility to be a part of that, writing those books, and also a huge honor. You know, I think about the Beverly Cleary and Judy Blume titles I read at that age, and they're part of who I am. So I think books for that age are just so important.
Yeah. Now, would you say Beverly Cleary and Judy Blume were, you know, sort of like inspirational in the way that you write, or are they not very much like you? I mean, are there authors who you turn to when you want motivation, and are there authors that perhaps you feel like you write more in their sort of style?
I think I write like me.
Yeah.
I don't know that I write exactly like anybody else, but for sure, I mean, there's a whole tradition of, you know, writers that I think we all draw inspiration from, and you know, there's a whole history of writing for children and young adults, and I think really all of us who are writing in this genre are part of that collective history and draw from it. I don't know that I share anybody's style. I will say that Marty McGuire, my new chapter book series with Scholastic, a couple of reviewers have compared Marty to Ramona, and I have to say that's just about the best compliment I ever could have gotten, because Beverly Cleary's Ramona Quimby was one of my very favorite characters as a kid.
Yeah, that's great. Now, do you obviously, as a teacher, you probably still read children's books, so whose books are you enjoying now?
Gosh, I have just a huge... I love to read, and children's books and young adult books make up the vast majority of what I do read, so...
Mm-hmm.
Linda Urban, who is a Vermont author, has a new book out this fall called Hound Dog True, and it's just an amazing story about a quiet girl finding her voice. It's a beautiful, beautiful middle grade novel. I love that. There's also a new book out this fall called Bigger Than a Bread Box by Laurel Snyder, and it's a wonderful mix of realistic fiction and a touch of magic, too. It's about a girl who discovers a magical bread box in her grandmother's attic, and when she wishes for something, it appears there, but then she comes to find out that those things that she's wishing for are coming from somewhere, and it creates this big, wonderful mess, and it just, that's another book, but it's just an amazing, amazing voice.
And then, any adult books that you're reading right now?
I read more kids' books than adult books, but right now I'm actually really enjoying The Magician King, which is a sequel to Lev Grossman's The Magicians.
Okay.
And if you haven't read that, it's sort of Harry Potter for grown-ups. It's a cross between Hogwarts and Narnia and 20-something angst. It's about these 20-something kids who go to a college for magicians.
Oh, wow.
So it's all the magic without maybe the innocence.
Okay.
But it's a really great, compelling, fascinating, and funny book, too.
Oh, great. Who reads your books, Kate, before you send them to your editor? Do you get feedback from anyone?
Oh, yeah. I have a critique group online. So three other writers that I actually share manuscripts with, and whenever one of us finishes something, we upload it to a Yahoo group, and the others will make comments in Microsoft Word and then send the comments and the feedback back. And I also have just a few friends with whom I'll exchange manuscripts more casually. Just mm-hmm. fire off an email and say, hey, yeah, I just finished this. Do you have time to look at it and provide some feedback? My kids read for me, too.
Okay, great.
And they actually provide really wonderful feedback and sometimes brutally honest feedback.
Yeah.
As well.
Now, are they fine with if you don't always take all their advice? Are they pretty cool with that? Or?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I think anybody who's a beta reader or a critique group member, all of us in this field, I think, understand that a suggestion is just that. It's a suggestion coming from one person. And even my editor sometimes will make a suggestion and say, you know, if this doesn't ring true, you know, we can talk about it and feel free to address this issue in another way if you have a different idea. So they're all suggestions. I think it's really when a few people make the same comments, like maybe a character doesn't feel true or, you know, a clue in a mystery isn't really making sense. When you have a few people make that same comment, that's when you really, really need to take notes.
Yeah. Now, your feedback group, are they all children's writers or what do they write?
They are. They write a mix of things, but all for children and young adults. Some fiction, some nonfiction, some picture books, a little bit of everything.
Okay. You mentioned that you have a couple books coming out.
I've actually got a pretty busy few seasons coming up. In February, I've got Marty McGuire, Biggs Worms, which is the second book in my Marty McGuire chapter book series with Scholastic.
Okay.
And that's for kids in grades 1 through 4.
All right.
It's a funny story about a third grade girl who would rather catch frogs and get muddy and catch crayfish than play with the princess clothes at dress-up time.
Yeah.
And so she, in the first book, Marty McGuire, they make her be the princess in the school play, so she has to find a creative way to make that part her own. And then in the second book, Marty McGuire Digs Worms, they have a school-wide challenge to come up with a project to help the environment. And Marty decides she's going to set up a worm farm in the cafeteria to eat everybody's leftover lunch. So that was a really fun, funny book to write. In March, I have Eye of the Storm, which is a novel for ages 10 to 14. And it's about that future world where tornadoes are bigger and more widespread than they are now. That was a really fun book to write because it has a lot of action. May is Capture the Flag, which is the first in a mystery series with Scholastic. And I think that's it for a little while. And then I have some more picture books coming down the pike later on, too.
Now, are all of those in the hands of editors at this point, or are you still actively writing all of those or some of those?
Those are all in the hands of editors and, in the case of Marty McGuire, illustrators at this point.
Okay.
So books get put to bed, so to speak, quite a while before they actually come out because there have to be review copies available and, you know, for School Library Journal and Publishers Weekly and things like that. So generally my work on a book ends about a year to 6 months before the book comes out.
Mm-hmm. Now, on your website, you have a blog, and you keep a pretty active blog. So I'm wondering, how often do you get to it, and do you enjoy writing your blog? Do you ever feel sort of like that time you'd rather be writing creatively, or do you look at that as creative writing, too? I'm asking a lot of questions all at once, but I wonder if you can comment about keeping a blog. Yeah.
Yeah. It's actually a lot of fun for me. You know, I use it for a lot of different things. I certainly use it to chronicle events that I'm at. I like to share pictures. Sometimes I write poetry that doesn't necessarily have a place to share, to be shared other than my blog. So I'll put it there, and I love that. I like photography a lot, too, so I end up sharing a lot of photographs of our, you know, hikes and things like that. It's really eclectic, I guess. I talk a lot about the writing process and teaching, because I do some educational consulting, too, in terms of reading and writing. So it's a little bit of everything, but it is. It's a labor of love for me. I really like it. I try to update it at least once a week.
Yeah.
Sometimes I have a lot to say, and it gets updated a lot more than that, but once a week is kind of the minimum for me.
Well, in one of your blog posts, you offered to share some of the best advice that you've received as a writer. And this radio show is for writers as well as readers. And so I was going to ask if we could just talk about a few of these. One of them was find your unique voice, which kind of goes back to what you said before about how you write like yourself and not like anyone else necessarily. So can we talk about that a little bit and how one can approach finding their unique voice?
Sure. That is a lesson that actually came to me. It's funny, you asked if my journalism background helps with my writing, and I guess that piece really did come through journalism for me. When I was just starting out writing television news, I was working in Syracuse. I was all of 19 years old, working at the NBC affiliate there, and producing. And so I was writing a lot of stories that were going to be read by this anchor man who was working there at the time. And I think to call him curmudgeonly would be generous. He was pretty grumpy.
Yeah.
But amazingly talented, brilliant writer, the best writer I had ever met. And I knew that. And then, so I knew that no matter how grouchy he was, he had a lot to teach me.
Uh-huh.
So I remember one night I had written this story that I was reporting. I'd covered this meeting, and I'd written a news story about it, and I was about to do record the package and do my voice recording, and he had to approve it. So I put it on his desk, and he grunted at it. And he crumpled it up and threw it in the garbage.
Oh.
And so I uncrumpled it, and I put it on his desk, and I said, "If you don't tell me what's wrong with this, I'm never going to get better."
Yeah.
And he looked at me, he said, "Do you want to learn?" And I said, "Yes, I want to learn." And he said, "Fine." And he said, "Who is this supposed to be?" And I said, what do you mean? And he, hit the paper. He said, "Who is this supposed to be?" I said, "What do you mean? It's me. I wrote it." He said, "This doesn't sound like you. Who are you trying to be?" And the truth of the matter is, there was in town at that time an incredibly talented investigative reporter named Cheryl Nathans. And I just idolized her. I thought her work was incredible. I wanted to be her when I grew up. And I was trying to sound like Cheryl Nathans.
Yeah.
And so I told him, I said, "Well, I was kind of trying to sound like, Cheryl Nathans." And he said, "There's your first problem. Because the job of being Cheryl Nathans is taken by Cheryl Nathans." And that's something that has always stayed with me.
Yeah.
That the job of being anybody, whether it's Cheryl Nathans or Judy Blume or Beverly Cleary or J.K. Rowling, is taken by that person. So while we can learn about style from reading and we can learn lots of different tricks of the trade, that voice is taken and you really need to develop your own. So I think the best way as a writer to do that is to just write and write and write and write about the things that matter to you and write in a way that's true to you deep down. And I don't mean true nonfiction. I mean true in terms of the heart and soul of the story.
Mm-hmm.
For me, that was the only way my real voice was going to come out.
Right. That's a great story and great advice as well. So you also, in your blog, you refer to a long list of other authors whose blogs you've found interesting or helpful. Can you just mention a couple of those now that people might refer to, particularly for writers?
Yeah, absolutely. When I was just starting out in writing for kids, I found reading other authors' blogs to be just tremendously useful,
mm-hmm.
especially authors who tend to talk a lot about process and how they write and how they revise and how they, find setting details and things like that.
Right.
So I think those are really great resources and education in and of themselves. Linda Urban is one of those authors. She's the author of Hound Dog True that I mentioned earlier.
Yep.
Another writer whose blog I just love is Cynthia Lord, who talks a lot about revision and how she writes. She's the author of Rules, which won a Newbery Honor a few years ago, and also the newer book, Touch Blue, set in a small island in Maine. Let's see, Carrie Madden is another writer who talks a lot about process.
Uh-huh.
Jill Knowles is a Vermont author. She writes more young adult books than middle grade, but she does a lot of community things for writers on her blog. She has, writing challenges and Monday morning writing prompts and things like that. So there's an awful lot out there, and I think you can learn a lot just from kind of being part of a writing community online.
Right, okay. Now, you just mentioned sort of her focus on community, and a couple of your recent blog posts have had to do with a benefit event that was held at the Bookstore Plus in Lake Placid, and these owners of the bookstore came up with the idea of benefit to raise money for the library in Upper Jay, New York, which had suffered terribly from Tropical Storm Irene. So I'm wondering how that event went, and if we could talk a little bit about the ways that reading inspires people to action.
Sure. Actually, that event and kind of a whole hullabaloo of fundraising for the library grew out of a drive that my husband and I took in the Adirondacks after Tropical Storm Irene had come through. He is a TV meteorologist and was very interested in the extent of the damage, particularly in Essex County. And so a few days after the storm, we took a drive and were, you know, coming upon these roads washed out and just houses with piles and piles of debris in front on things that had been flooded and dragged out, just sopping wet, you know, toys and clothes and you name it. It was sopping wet in the front yard. And we came upon what looked like another house and with just a heap outside. And I caught my breath because it was the Wells Memorial Library in Upper Jay. And that heap was all books. It was a pile of books as tall as I was, just a huge, huge heap of sopping wet books. Which from a reader and a writer's perspective absolutely broke my heart. But this was also a library where I had done one of my very first author events. So to see it devastated like that was really sad. So we stopped and, you know, checked out what was going on, figured out what had happened and, you know, talked with the librarian a little bit and she showed us how high the water had come up. They'd lost virtually their entire children's collection because the kids' books were all on the low shelves where the children could reach them.
Oh, yeah.
So, I had my camera with me and said, you know what, I bet some people who read my blog will want to help. And, you know, I was actually thinking that a lot of my author friends would say, oh, I can send one of my books or I can send this book. But what happened instead, in addition to that, was the blog post just really touched people's hearts. I think people who love books and libraries are really passionate about that. And when they saw what had happened to this small library, you know, they wanted to help. And so we had, you know, kids in Colorado setting up lemonade stands to raise money for this library in the Adirondacks and, you know, publishers sending piles and boxes of books from their list. And it was just really an amazing effort. And Sarah and Mark at the Bookstore Plus said, you know what, we want to help and maybe we can do some kind of a fundraiser and we could have some authors and we could have a silent auction. And so, you know, it just became this larger-than-life thing with people reaching out. And it was really just amazing to be a part of it. The community of people who write and read and share books for kids is just pretty incredible. So the fundraiser was a great success. I know the Bookstore Plus collected well over $3,000 on a gift card for the library. I know they raised at least well over another $1,000 that night to go toward their rebuilding. It was a great event.
Oh, that's wonderful. So I have one last question for you, Kate. In a recent interview that you conducted on your blog, you asked the author Laurel Snyder to talk about her approach to revision. And part of that conversation had to do with pacing. She mentioned that in managing the pace of a book, vast sections and key characters often get cut. And I wonder if that's true for you, and also if you have any advice for other writers about pacing and how you handle pacing in your books.
Yeah, I mean, I end up cutting a lot. I am a pretty fat writer when it comes to first drafts. Mm-hmm. I was in this book, Eye of the Storm, that comes out in March, which is, you know, right now, very fast-paced and, you know, it's a thriller. But in the original draft, there's a scene where these characters have a picnic. They, you know, go out into the field and have a picnic. And I honestly think I had felt the need to describe every single pine cone that they stepped over on the way there. I tend to write long in my first drafts, and I do a lot of description. And some of that is wonderful, and it stays, and it has a point. Some of it is just verbose, and it really has to go, or else, you know, who wants to hear about every last pine cone?
Right.
So that's something that I know I need to do with myself as a writer, is be very disciplined about what stays in the draft and what goes, and is each scene really moving the story forward, and is it essential? So I think those are really good questions for any writer to ask.
Yeah, that's great. Now, do you still find that in getting reactions from people, your readers are sometimes telling you, this needs to move a little differently, or move along a little faster, or you've got too much here?
You mean critique group?
Your critique group, or even, you know, once something gets to an editor, do you find that that's still a theme that you still have to go back and sometimes kind of work with that?
Yeah, I mean, definitely. I mean, my critique group I've been with for several years, and so we all sort of know what the other writers' Achilles heels are, so to speak.
Right.
So, you know, they know that that's something that I'm always looking for help with.
Yeah.
And in fact, sometimes I'll post a story and say, you know, I'm really looking to cut the word count on this to get it down a little bit. What do you think I could cut? And I have, you know, one member in particular who's relentless about that. He edits with an axe, so that tends to work out well.
Well, that's great. Kate, thank you so much for talking to me tonight. This has been really interesting, and I really enjoyed Over and Under the Snow, and I wish you all the best of luck with it.
Thank you so much for the opportunity. It's been great to talk with you.
I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Kate Messner. You can learn more about her work on her website, katemessner.com. You can also follow her on Twitter at Kate Messner. This week's Write the Book prompt is inspired by my interview with Kate Messner, who started to write Over and Under the Snow after her class's snowshoeing field trip. Write a poem, story, or scene that has to do with a winter sport. Good luck with this prompt, and please listen next week for another. Write the Book and The Radiator are supported in part by Calamity and Crow's Trading Post, twisting fresh tie-dyes for individuals, businesses, and organizations with standards like eyeballs, Jerry Bears, peace signs, and their signature tie-dyed mule. Custom artisan tie-dyes that rock. Contact Calamity and Crow's Trading Post on Facebook. And by The Farmhouse, Burlington's farm-to-table gastropub, serving award-winning burgers, innovative entrees, and a world-class craft beer menu. If you're interested in sharing this show with out-of-town friends, let them know they can stream it live at theradiator.org every Monday from 2 to 3. Archived episodes of Write the Book are also available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. You can visit Write the Book on Twitter and Write the Book Radio Show on Facebook for updates. You can also access the podcast at my own website, shelaughswithoutus.com. My co-host Gary's website is GaryLeeMiller.com. If you have a guest to suggest or comments about the show or news about book-related events, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. Finally, please remember that this station is here thanks to community support and involvement. More information about The Radiator is available online at theradiator.org. Please remember that The Radiator exists thanks to community support and involvement. More information about The Radiator is available online at theradiator.org. This has been Write the Book. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and you're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMM, LP, Burlington, Vermont.